I got a little red rooster, too lazy crow for day. Everything in your barnyard upset in every way. Dogs begin to bark, hounds start to howl. Dogs begin to bark, hounds start to howl. Watch out, strange people, red roosters on the prowl. If you see my little red rooster, please drive him home. Somebody drive my heart.
Greetings. Welcome to Confessing the Blues. I'm your host, Jim Ange Anderson. We started the show off with Little Red Rooster by Funky Mojo Daddy, featuring our guest today, Mr. Kenny Kinsey. Bassist, singer, songwriter, producer, recording artist, and member of the Kinsey Report and Funky Mojo Daddy, Kenny Kinsey was just recently inducted into the Chicago Blues Hall of Fame. Let's roll! Kenny Kinsey, welcome to the Farmhouse Studios.
All right, glad to be here. Thanks.
Well, you got the Funky Mojo Daddy has a big show coming up on New Year's Eve at Beer Geeks. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we actually looking really forth to that. It's going to be myself, Jerry Porter, Jeff Massey, which is three of the original members of Mojo Daddy. We kind of started out as a jam band at Leroy's Hot Stuff.
Right.
Over 10 years ago.
Yeah, wow.
And the story on that was, you know, it was kind of a slow period for everybody. And we said, you know, Leroy said, why don't y'all do a jam night and stuff? And he used to have jam nights. So we said, well, we'll do it for the summer. And the summer led into over 10 years
right.
of doing it. But, you know, it was, people was excited about it. I mean, it was our Sunday night was a hot night. And it just kind of grew from us doing that to like doing gigs and other things, and the band just kind of, you know, grew from there, and we just, you know, started playing all over, and One of the Nick Burke was with us, you know, for a long time. Corey Dennison, and right now I'm using Ryan Fromm as second guitar with the band. But we kind of go in and out over the years. You know, Omar Coleman was did some shows with us. Like I said, Corey Dennison.
Sure.
And so right now though, the core band now is me, Jeff, and Jerry. And like I said, I use Ryan a lot, Ryan Fromm a lot. Sometimes I use TJ Jenkins on keyboards, which is cool. Sometimes the one guitar on the keyboard is brings a different element, different sound to the band. But we at Beer Geeks though, we'll be Ryan Fromm will be with the three of us. And Beer Geeks is a good place to have over in Northwest Indiana. It's located in Highland, and he's dedicated to trying to bring the blues there. And he was doing it consistently every Tuesday.
Every Tuesday Blues Day, right?
Yeah, for a good 5-6 years there. And but it's not like Chicago things. People get used to it and then it falls off. And so he's just doing shows, kind of special event shows.
Right.
And he called me and asked me about that. So we're looking really forth to doing that.
And they're located at 3030 45th Avenue in Highland.
Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's great to have a place where there's good beer geeks, and great music. I mean, it seems like it would be a great place to spend New Year's Eve, without having to go into the city.
Yeah. And it's one of the few places in Indiana, at least up in that part, that's non-smoking. He was non-smoking from the day that he opened up. So a lot of people like going there that don't like dealing with the smoke and everything. Even from a musician standpoint, they don't really like dealing with the smoke and trying to sing or whatever in the smoky room. So he's serving food now as well. So, so far we've been getting, a lot of people been asking about the show. So I'm looking forward to a good turnout. Hopefully we don't get any snow or anything that's going to hamper the turnout, but seemed like it's gonna be a good night.
And so the Funky Mojo Daddy is basically like an all-star group, it seems like, so no matter where you go, because I know you have some other shows throughout the month, you're gonna do one of the shows opening up for Buddy Guy at the end of the month.
Sunday, January 28th. We're gonna open up, and the band just kind of grew. We did the one record, and it created the buzz for us, and we actually did some out-of-town shows. But the band's pretty much built its reputation on word of mouth. Yeah. It's like you say, it's guys that's made up from different bands, and it kind of grew out of the jam night. But we kind of bring different things to the table that we don't do with our original band. Say, for me, Kinsey Report, for Jeff, Steepwater. Jerry, he's been a road guy with Buddy and Junior and everybody else
James
in
Cotton,
Chicago.
Yeah. Right.
Ryan Fromm with his band Green Room Rockers and Upside Down and Backwards. So in his main band, he does ska reggae kind of thing.
Yeah.
And stuff. But but with us, he plays blues and soul and stuff. So, but we kind of bring all that background to Mojo Daddy, and we incorporate it, and we kind of it's a blues cover band, but we kind of put our own twist on a lot of the songs, a lot of the standard songs, and I think it's a good mix.
Thank you.
looking forward to the future and doing some things. I think everybody is getting the itch now that, hey, we know we need to, like, put out a product.
Right.
And so I'm looking forward to, you know, upcoming year getting some things done.
That's good. I mean, I think more and more of the people see a group and they want it. They want to get a record. They want to get a CD or download whatever you have available.
Well, you know? And, you know, after you've been around a while, you know, it's you just need to do something fresh and you know, people see you over a period of time, especially around here. If you're in the city or you're traveling, you can kind of do your same show for a while. But when you hear people that's don't see you repeatedly, they expect something different. And just for our own challenge and creativity, we need to do some, put out a new product.
Yeah.
And some of that, you know, we'll get into it, but I'm just kind of, I lost my wife this past November. So just kind of ironing out a lot of things that go along with the loss of a loved one and get things settled. And then, you know,
sure.
I'm ready to, you know, but it's not a process that, it's automatic, or there's a format to it. You just gotta kind of let it go as it goes and come as it comes and stuff.
Right.
So, but I know I'm ready to. You know, it's gonna be good therapy for me to kind of go ahead and once get things settled down and get back in the basement and get to writing and plan.
Yeah. You know? Well, you know what? I've discovered that there's a certain healing power in music. I mean, I think that we all enjoy it and are passionate about it.
Yeah.
But after the loss of a loved one, it really does help. And sort
yeah.
of,
yeah.
I mean, you can't replace the person, but it sort of takes the edge off and gives you something to look forward to and something to enjoy.
Yeah.
That's really, you know, from your heart.
Yeah. And it's, though, it's this for me is so new. It's just something that I'm dealing with every day. You know,
sure.
Every day is a different day. So I'm just taking it moment by moment. And, you know, when the spirit hits you, you know, let it come out, whether that's emotional or musically and stuff, you know. So I keep a recorder by me, or if I hear a song and I hear a groove or something, I make sure I jot it down, because as you know, you know, if you try to keep it in your head till tomorrow,
right,
it's more than likely it's going to be gone. So I always try to, something hit me, I try to get that moment down, and I come back to it later on.
Sure. Yeah, you got to either write it down or
yeah.
sing it into your phone
yeah.
or something, because yeah. it goes away.
Yeah.
you know? Yeah. But that's exciting. I would think that the dynamic of the different guys in the group would you know, come up with something fresh. I mean, I think when I've seen you guys perform in all different iterations, it seemed like there's just a very high level of musicianship.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I think that keeps it fresh too. I mean, with having Jerry as the foundation, as the drummer, I mean, he's been, you know, he's been a rock solid drummer for years with different people. And I my thing is to keep that foundation as well and stuff. I try to just keep a good groove, a good pocket. And then, you know, let these fiery guitar players, you know, swing at it and stuff. And that's kind of been, you know, our form. Everybody, you know, brings some singing. Of course, you know, you got, you know, one singer maybe a little bit more. But it's kind of like a football team where we're not just a passing team and stuff. You know, you got.
Right, special team, running game.
Yeah, yeah.
right, right.
So. I kind of look at it like that, and that keeps it, you know, keeps it fresh and keeps it balanced and stuff.
Yeah. I used to think that seeing the Leroy's, the jam session, that you guys were so good that would intimidate some of the guitar players from even thinking about coming up.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's good. It kind of separates the men from the boys.
Yeah, yeah. I think it might have been some of that from time to time, but I always tried to welcome everybody,
sure.
you know, and if anybody was like, you know, well, Kenny, man, can you play with me? I said, yeah, you know, I'll play. And a lot of time, it got to the point sometime to where some of the guys didn't want to play with somebody that was, you know, maybe less talented.
Sure.
But it's like, you have to remind everybody it's jam night, and that's what we're supposed to do and stuff, you know, to keep it going.
Right, and that's give everybody the opportunity. That's where we all started,
exactly.
You know, kind of learning and fall down and get back up and
yeah.
and That's kind of what the jam session is all about.
Yeah, and you know, like I said, and over the years, you know, we don't finally worked our way up to opening for Buddy Guy. You know,
right?
We been lucky to work there on a regular basis for the last few years. We get a Wednesday night or Thursday night on a regular basis.
At Legends.
At Legends, right. Yeah. And so the management over there finally said, hey, man, you know, we got you a night to open up for Buddy. And we like, yes.
Yeah, that's a great gig.
That's a great gig.
And you guys also perform at the House of Blues?
House of Blues on a regular basis, yeah.
The Harlem Avenue Lounge.
We just did that last Saturday, I believe, as a trio.
Uh-huh.
It was just me, Jeff, and Jerry. It actually went good. Kenny's always tried to micromanage the bands and the shows and stuff. Well, hey, Kit, so you just come in as a three-piece, huh? Why is that? You know, like, Kenny, don't worry about it. It's going to be good.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. It's going to be all right. And sure enough, it was a good turnout, good show, you know. I said, don't, you know, we're not going to, I'm going to do the gig if I didn't have confidence that it was going to be good.
With that lineup, I mean,
you
can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You can't go wrong. So. And I know we worked with you guys at a festival out in Ohio. Was it Ohio? Yeah, in Ohio a couple summers ago. So you guys do some traveling as well. Right?
Yeah, we do some traveling. With Mojo Daddy, I primarily just kind of look or people that want to ask me about things. I just kind of do the Great Lakes. I just kind of, you know, maybe Minnesota, but Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio.
So like staying within 400 miles
or
something.
I mean, and if something comes up, you know, to where it's farther, then, you know, I take a look at it and see everything, you know, in the end, I love to play, but it's all economics like any other business. And so you just kind of have to look at it. And even with Kinsey Report right now, you know, people, because they see what I'm doing with Mojo Daddy, and they actually, you know, see more dates with me doing Mojo Daddy than with the Kinsey Report,
right.
And they ask me about that. And I said, well, there's a couple things that go into that. This, number one, the band is older, and we choose not, you know, we basically choose not to be jumping in the van like we were 20 years ago,
right.
And bar hopping and stuff. Number two, the money for that is not what it used to be. And, you know, of course, the cost of getting on the road is going, you know, is up high.
Right. Gas, you know, hotel rooms, all that.
That. And so, you know, that's two of the reasons, and just the whole physicality of, you know, lugging equipment in and out and stuff. You know, it's just, like I say, the band's gotten older, and we just kind of choose not to do that as much as we do. And, you know, hopefully when the summer, spring rolls around, we get the calls for the festivals again. And, you know, we go out and do, you know, a handful of festivals in the summertime. And if we can put some club gigs around that, and do a 3-4 day run, then we can do that. But driving all the way to New York just to play at a bar and turn back around and come home, we're not really doing that.
Right,
anymore.
Been there, done that.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
We're not really doing that anymore. And so, you know, it kind of leads us to doing other things and stuff. Right now, Donald is doing some touring with the Wailers. They got the bass player, Family Man. He's the original Wailer from the beginning of Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Right.
So he's kind of the anchor with that. And I think Junior Marvin's in the band and Donald. And then the rest of them is made up of sons and cousins or whatever of the band. And so, but they tour, they tour nonstop. And Don, you know, it kind of went from doing a couple shows, pickup shows with them here and there to like touring with them.
Yeah.
So it makes it hard, and it's, you know, it's like, hey man, you know, this is pretty smooth for me and stuff. You know, I'm making money,
sure.
I don't have to be carrying my own app. I got the
crew. Better situation on the road.
So, you know, it kind of cuts back into Kinsey gigs and stuff. But I kind of saw years ago where things was kind of going to navigate towards or whatever, and that's why I kind of started my side project, because, you know, gigs was 10 years ago was winding down from my heyday, I would say, in the 80s and the 90s. you know, late 90s, you can see where things was kind of tapering off.
Changing,
a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I say, hey, you know, we got to do something else that where, you know, the big Kinsey money is not going to be coming around that often and stuff. So, but if I can do something locally to keep things going, I gotta look into that. And so, you know, I'm doing what I do. Ralph, you talked about him with his art,
his
my
artwork,
brother Ralph.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, everybody's got some different things going on, but, the touring for Kinsey Report, you know, kind of just is spotty, but we look forth to the summertime and the festivals. And of course, even with Kinsey Report, you know, we have to try to, you know, get going with a project, a CD with that as well.
You guys released an EP recently?
We released that maybe about 4 years ago.
Okay.
About 4 years ago. And it, you know, it creates some interest and stuff. It was mainly, and I see it overallly in the music business now, is that a CD is almost a promotional tool now.
Yeah.
I mean, if you putting a CD out to sell a lot, and people talk about hit records and gold records and stuff, that's
those days are gone.
Yeah. You get your publicist if you can afford one, and put the CD out and use that to get better shows. That's, to me, that's what I look at it like. And you sell product off the bandstand, you know. You print up CDs and sell them off the band. You get that instant sell. People are excited, and that's good. But going into, you know, there's no more, number one, no more mom and pop record stores for the most part. I mean,
there's barely any
large
stores either, you know.
Yeah, I mean, at one time I used to go in the Best Buy and see Kinsey Report records in the band, but not, you know, you don't see that no more. So other than what anybody can do now with the internet and stuff, you know, iTunes, you know, CD Baby and stuff, everybody can put stuff out and people download. And like I say, on the road, you can offer people, you know, vinyl, you know, whatever format you want to put. Speaking of Ryan that plays with me with Mojo Day, his band, Green Room Rockers, they just put out a cassette. just gimmickry stuff.
You're
going back to cassettes now and stuff, you know. So, but you just use it as a promotional tool or something, you know.
Right. It almost seemed like streaming is where stuff is going. More people stream stuff than buy stuff.
Yeah.
It's almost like AirPlay used to be, where if you're getting a lot of streams, it means you're getting a lot of ears, a lot of people listening to your music, you know. But it doesn't turn into income.
No, very much.
Yeah.
The excitement of hearing you or festival promoter hearing you or seeing your name on some of the record charts or whatever for us, AirPlay and stuff. You know, little things like that that create buzz that get you onto some of the major festivals and stuff, and then that turns over into income. And of course, you always have an opportunity to sell more product at a festival. Then if you're playing a local bar or something like that. So that's my, you know, main priority. And that's probably also why you see artists like us doing projects at either in your home studio or smaller studios now. And you don't have to really, like, invest a ton of money into making a CD nowadays. And you can get a quick return, and like I say, use it as a promotional tool. And if you can sell it, that's great.
Right.
But put it out there and let people know that you got something new.
Use me, baby, till I'm all used up. she always told. Car broke down, said she ran out of gas. Sounds like a slur, baby, you can kiss mine. That's it, I'm taking all I can take, baby. That's it, it's just too much at stake.
I've read somewhere where 65-70% of people discover new music on YouTube. So almost you have to have a video now that goes along with it, even if it's just your lyrics scrolling down, just something, you know.
Yeah, it's and it that's another conversation. me and my brothers, we go back and forth with that. You know, why we got to give, you know, free? When you see people out there, artists out there, that's major artists, that's, you know, just letting people download a tune for free, you know, you that's the kind of thing that you up against and stuff. So you have to kind of just, you know, be competitive and and make ourselves like I keep coming back to, you know, on the bandstand and stuff at festivals. It's just a means of touring, and that's where you make your money at, of doing shows. And then you have to kind of just, you know, like I spoke before, be strategic about that and choose where you want to go, the markets you want to hit, and kind of concentrate on that. I mean, I think with the, speaking of that EP that Kensburyport did a few years back, I mean, we sent that all over the country, but we didn't have a tour of the country, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's probably okay to send it to a radio station or a blues, you know, guy in California, so that they can have it and play it. But you can't really invest a lot of money out there when you never know. When
you're not going to be working out there.
You're not going to be working out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to think about where you want to go with your product and your marketing, and spend your bucks where you know you're going to potentially make some money at.
I was talking about making money with music. I know that you guys have done some publishing and have sold some songs, and that's another area where a musician can actually make some money.
Yeah, we own our own publishing, and that's, you know, it's a lot of times, you know, you kind of, well, if I give up a little publishing or whatever, I might get some more opportunities. But in the long run, it's best to own your own publishing,
right,
and make deals and negotiate versus just turning it over to somebody else.
Sure.
And we've had some songs placed in commercials, a couple TV series, and other people, you know.
I think I saw John Fogerty recorded one of your songs.
Well, no, we recorded one of his
songs. Oh, you recorded one of his songs.
Yeah, recorded one of his songs.
It sounds like you guys wrote it.
Yeah. Well, once again, you know, we put our own spin, you know, right. Brothers Kensburyport, Mojo Day, we kind of put our own spin on somebody else's song. Yeah, you got to try to, you know, maintain some ownership, keeping control of your masters. You know, and that's another battle, too, that you can have with record companies. You know, I mean, especially the independent blues labels and stuff.
They want to take the publishing and just cut you a little check, right?
Cut you a check. They want to own the masters because that's long-term income for them.
Yeah.
And if, you know, 25 years from now, if they want to sell the company, you know.
They got it.
And,
assets, yeah.
And, you know, my dad did a couple of records with the Verb label back in the 90s, and didn't really do nothing with the, you know, major money, you know, didn't really do nothing with the record. I think they end up selling the masters to House of Blues. They tried to start a label,
right,
there for a while. Now I think they don't sold it to somebody else. So once they have the masters, they can just keep on selling it. You, and in the end, you don't know where it's at. You know,
right,
to be honest with you. You know, you stop seeing statements, you know, and
you're making money for Disney or something.
You don't even know it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you know, they give you all that advance money to make the record. And so you know, it ain't really sold, but they got the master. So they selling it. Like you said, you know, you might hear the song somewhere on the Disney Channel somewhere as a backing track. You ain't going to see a dime. Well, we got to recoup from, you know, 20 years ago and stuff, you know. That's the sour part of the business, and, you know, keeps a lot of bitterness, especially with the older artists, you know, with the business.
You hear the same old story from all these people. They got a little bit of money for a recording session,
right?
It became a big hit, and they didn't get anything in addition to that.
Right.
I mean, maybe
right.
some notoriety,
right,
and then another bad record contract after that. You know,
and so it's. That's just one, you know, thing. You never know. We did a couple of records with, like you mentioned, with Virgin. And they didn't owe a lot of money. You know, it was, I mean, I tell everybody I made more money in the 90s than any time in my career and stuff. You
right.
know? And, but they didn't know, you know, they had money to spend. They didn't, but they marketed, they just thought that they could take, you know, the artists to another level without and overlook the grassroots blues people that had been supporting us,
right,
what made them excited about us and stuff.
Sure.
You know, and that's kind of overlooked it, but those records are out there once again, you know, masters somewhere. I mean, we own the, you know, we got the rights to our songs, but those particular versions and
those recordings,
and the money, you know, if anything ever happens, they're gonna say, well, you know, we didn't have them recoup nothing yet, so you know, it's gonna be one of those type of things and stuff. But you, once again, as the years go by, you just stop. You see less and less statements. You know,
right?
You don't know. You know, if, to me, and by right, you know, if it ain't sold but 5 units, you should get a statement saying, "Hey,
yeah,
you know, this quarter you only sold, you know," and those statements should still come in. But you know, little by little, that doesn't happen. But I will give Alligator credit. It's been 20 years since we did those records, but we get our semi-annually reports from them, you know, showing what, you know, where the records are at, you know, what was sold.
Sure.
So I give Bruce credit for that. Even now, he, you know, he's right on the due date, you know, with his statements and checks, you know.
Yeah, so that's good to hear. Because, and he's sort of grounded in the blues, and he didn't try to take it to a different level like the Virgin stuff. I mean, that's where he started, that's where he still is. Hopefully he does right by everybody.
I hear sometimes, from time to time, we have a rare meeting with him even now, and you know, he'd be on the phone, get a phone call from Hound Dogs, Taylor grandson or something.
Right.
But he's still paying the family and stuff. You know, whatever's in, you know, he's still making money. But he's still passing that money just because the artist don't pass on. You know, they offspring still receives, you know. And it's just a matter of just having your business together.
Sure.
And or him wanting to do right by you and stuff. Even if the business wasn't ever set up correctly, you know, if he's a good label owner and know that, hey man, this money, you know, needs to, it's not mine, you know, it's the artist, it needs to go to the family, so, and do the right thing. And I believe, you know, he's not perfect by no means, but he's a record label owner,
but
at least he does that, you know. So, and I give him props for that.
I used to do a little work with Jimmy Dawkins, and part of what he did was try to recoup some royalties that were owed to a lot of musicians, you know, and because it's the same old story about people sign something and they make this record, and you know, so he was trying to get some money from the, you know, the Chess records and VJ and all that for some of these artists who made these records and got big hits, and the families weren't getting any money, you know. So
that's strange that you say that, because I met his son at the Blues Hall of Fame induction this past year. And we just spoke briefly, but he said, yeah, man, you know, my dad owns a lot of publishing and stuff, man. My dad, you know, and I didn't, because I never heard that before. But now that you mention that, you know.
He published some of my stuff.
So he, you know, you never know behind the scenes. You know, you see artists and their persona and stuff, but behind the scenes, the business sense that they have, to make sure they protect themselves and other artists as well and stuff. And that was a surprise to me. I didn't know that.
So you mentioned the Chicago Blues Hall of Fame. You were just inducted. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, they, my brother Ralph and I were inducted this past year into that. So that and Donald, he got inducted the year before. So that was a good honor and stuff, you know. I appreciate it. It ain't changed my money. My money didn't go up, but I could put it on my resume and stuff. You know, put it on my website.
Well, it's nice to get recognition from your peers.
Exactly. You know, exactly.
All the years you've been out there.
Yeah. And so it was a good thing. It was a good thing. Yeah. I appreciate it.
That's cool. Well, also you talked about your father, Lester Big Daddy Kinsey, and he was a blues man, so I'm sure there was many lessons that he provided to his sons about music and about the music business. Can you talk a little bit about your father?
Yeah. He was dad. He was the root of the music in the Kinsey household. Briefly, you know, his parents was brought up in the church. My, mm-hmm. my grandfather was a Pentecostal minister, and my grandmother, you know, she was a church mother, and they was 100% church all the way. I mean, every Sunday shut in. That's where my brothers first started playing music is okay. in the church. And my dad, you know, my dad and my grandfather bumped heads all the time and stuff. I don't know. He played in the church early on, but he kind of got the blues bug and kind of just left the church. And when they moved north, my grandmother, I believe, kind of insisted on the grandkids coming to church. And so, you know, we just kind of picked up in the Holiness Church. You know, music is the praise is a big part of the whole thing and stuff, the holiness. And when you start getting fulfilled with the Holy Ghost and stuff, you get that music going and the saints start jumping around and stuff, you know. So that's a big part of where we got music from.
Every day there's something new. Fear and desire at war with me and you. All I need is peace of mind, love and affection I'm trying to find. Just this morning I rise like the sun. I'll be standing till my work is done. I'm standing on solid ground. I shall not be moved till the thrones come down. Just this morning, I rise like the sun. I'll be standing till my work is done.
My dad got the blues bug, and he was Jimmy Reed, Muddy Waters. You know, that was just common in the house. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was just, it's almost like it wasn't a major deal because it was just a part of the what you heard every day playing in the house.
Right.
And if, you know, the guys that came around, you know, that's it was our house on the block at that time was in Gary, for me when I was born on Chase Street. And it was just it was commonplace for, you know, guys coming in and out, you know, rehearsing. We always said that the neighbors always looked at us probably kind of funny and stuff. It was like the party house on the right. block or whatever. And during that time, my dad did party a lot and stuff.
Right.
And but it was all good though. It was never no trouble. You know, it was, mm-hmm. you know, it was all about the music and having a good time. But yeah, he down through the years, you know, my brothers when they was younger, they would do tours throughout the South, and you know, with Donald and the band, you know, my brothers they got out there did different projects and stuff and went through the reggae scene, the White Lightning scene, but. Then came along the 80s. My dad got back into music. I think at that time, Ralph and Don, they were still out in California doing a project. And so that's when I started playing. I was, I don't know, probably sophomore in high school. And Dad started bringing some of his old-timers back over to the house. And I started playing. And things didn't work out with them in California. They moved back home and, you know, say, hey, man, you know, they thought I was ready to take over bass. And so that's when we put Big Daddy Kinsey and the Kinsey Report together and we started doing local shows. I think one of my first paying shows was down at the Gary Sheraton Hotel that they used to have downtown Gary. And, so it just kind of started from there. And
did the bass find you or did you find the bass? I mean, because they had a guitar player and a
right,
drummer.
Right. Yeah. You know what? I think it was a little bit of both. Because I kind of, when I first started picking up any instrument, my mother wanted me to play piano, I believe. And she I had piano lessons from Ralph's wife. Grandmother, Mrs. Gray, yeah.
Right.
And but I was the only boy that was taking lessons. And this is an old lady, and she had these girls, and I'm the only boy, you know,
right.
playing. And I was like, no, I just ain't cool.
So, yeah.
Yeah. But I learned the basics. And then I think in middle school, elementary school, I, you know, played the horn, you know, just did all the little things, you know, the marching
just
band.
Just trying
yeah,
out different
trying
things.
Different
yeah.
things and stuff. But about time I came around to high school or junior high, bass guitar was really popular. You know, Larry Graham and
sure.
thumping, and popping and stuff.
Yeah.
That was you know, you as a bass player, you got to thump and pop and stuff during that time. So I kind of gravitated to the bass and stuff because that was the powerful instrument during that time. And I would, you know, the guys, they would rehearse at the house and they would leave the instruments at the house and I would just go downstairs and pick up the bass and just kind of went from there. And then my dad, I call it the home shopping network. Some guys came around, you know, because they knew my dad always had one needed equipment or something.
Sure.
Hey, Big Daddy, I got a bass here, man. You need a bass guitar, I give it to you for $30 or something. And he got it, and that was my first bass, and I still
cool.
own that bass now and stuff.
That's excellent.
Yeah, I don't know where it came from. It was the home shopping network.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
right.
But, yeah, so I, you know, and from high school, it's just, I stuck with it, you know. And even when I went off to school for a couple of years, you know, I took my bass and I went to school in Chicago. So every now and then I go down to Blues and Halstead. And, you know, that was days when Johnny Little John, Sonny Lance Slim, and all the old timers like that was still around
right.
and stuff, and Big Moose. And so we would go down there and listen to some of the blues guys during that time. But yeah, I think the bass, you know, we kind of just, you know, fell in these shows hands. And but I get that a lot though. You know, did you purposely pick up the bass because it was a drum and a guitar player?
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know. You know, that's no. I had a choice. My brothers, my dad kind of like almost, I wouldn't say forced them to play, but he was a little bit more forceful with them to play.
Okay.
Whereas me, I had a choice. I could have went and did anything I wanted to do. But I chose this path.
Were there some bass players on the scene in Chicago that you enjoyed or tried to emulate or learn from at the time in the '80s?
No, I tell people because people ask me about influences, and I was more influenced by the record and the bass part that I heard on any record. It could have been any artist, it could have been any bass player, but if I heard that record and I liked that bass line,
right,
that's what I was influenced by. And as I've gotten older, I tell people, Paul McCartney, singer bass players, that's who I kind of look to, because that's an art.
It's hard to do both.
To do both.
Yeah.
And I kind of like, man, that's cool that, you know, guys that can just, you know, without any effort, play and sing and hold it down, you know. I'm influenced by those bass players and not, you mentioned the Jockos and sure. The Clarks and everybody and stuff, but I'm more influenced by groove bass players and the foundation of the art of playing bass so much than the wizardry of it. And but I kind of look, Nathan Neese is probably one of my top influences that I just pretty much love everything he does. He's so versatile.
Side of town when the hippie looking man came in to sit down. We were getting down. He listened to us play a couple of jams and said, "My name is Sam. Would you like to make a record? I really dig your band." Said to myself, "One day we're gonna make it to the big time." Oh, yeah.
So that's a wrap for this week's show, part one with Kenny Kinsey. Check back next week for part two. A couple of shows of note. Saturday, December 30th, you can check out Kenny with the Wayne Baker Brooks Band at Buddy Guy's Legends in Chicago. Of course, Sunday, New Year's Eve, December 31st, with Funky Mojo Daddy at Beer Geeks in Highland, Indiana. Another special show, Sunday, January 28th. Funky Mojo Daddies will be opening up for the legendary Buddy Guy at Buddy Guy's Legends in Chicago. For all other shows, check out kenkinsey.com. See you next year.